Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 15th of September 2018, episode 3, and we've read a couple of articles from New Scientist. There's a series of articles where something's clearly not of scientific value. In the very first paragraph, you can tell it's not going to be of scientific value. Goes along, then it discloses to the careful reader that it's not of scientific value. Then there's some quotes which from other researchers reviewing that no, it's not of scientific value, questionable scientific value, and then it finishes with the speculative thing, or perhaps if it was a value. And of course this is okay, it's just there's a lot of articles on that level, and then there's articles of some merit, but also of some pop view, people speculating what you could do with CRISPR and various things. There are some very good articles which are reviews, like, or the commentary from Schrodinger stuff, or some historical one. That's fantastic. You can't beat them. There's recently been an article, or the most recent article I've read is one about the biome and diet, and you struggle to think it's all about this pop hype and what exactly the person says. I'll have a quick look. And it was more, I suppose, there's some key aspects of it, but it's buried in it. It was saying that too much fiber might be bad for you in there. But we come up to an article called The Horror of Hassan Lu. Horror of Hassan Lu. It's one of the few articles. I'm not saying this is, there's only a few articles. It's just a fact of statistics and significance. Like, you can't have every 1 in 100 articles hitting you every time. There is this 1 in 100 articles, 1 in 1,000 articles, which is significant, and thought provoking and sad and deep. And this is one article, and basically it's an article where there's a war crime which has occurred, a massacre which has occurred 30,000 years, 3,000 BC, 5,000 years ago, and what's left with you is the people either side of the massacre, who was massacred, by whom was massacred, is gone. It's no longer a point of being able to take sides, or for me, being able to take sides. It's the unearthly feeling that this is human nature. That in a museum we like to celebrate the pottery and implements, and we like to tell a story about ourselves, which are a little bit romanticized, and we have this sort of very dull thing to face, to look at yourself, and to see, when you look at yourself in the mirror, you see a million years of evolution, you see a whole lot of things, but you tend to say, look, I can see the Renaissance and all that type of stuff happening in your face, when you look at yourself, you can see these sorts of things. You can see someone sort of naively believing in God. There's a period of naivety before the Enlightenment, and a sort of maturity there, that sort of feeling there. But to all sort of like, this is uncovers that you and I are basically war criminals. Or what's more possible is that we're living in a society where we deny the possibility, and then we come up against corruptions, groups of corrupt people, and they hang on perfectly well because they can spread the myth that this sort of thing doesn't happen. So I'm going to read this to you. It's a very serious and somber thing I'm going to read. And The Horror of Hassan Lu, The truth about the once great Iron Age city lay buried for 3 millennia. Now, at last, the story of Pompeii of Iran can be told. Catherine Barrick reports. Okay, well, unfortunately, I do have a problem here. I think at that time is before the Iron Age. The Iron Age is, the Greeks' civilization didn't have iron. It had bronze. But let's stop. There's a picture. And it's this picture of all these people massacred. Just all massacred. Look, it's like a war. It's a horrible thing. There's skeletons on a desk, I think, and they're laid out in such a way. There's a horror in the faces, just the way they're laid out. It's horrible. And it says the byline for it, or the caption is, "Stop the clocks." A fire set during the sacking of Hasanlu preserved details of the gruesome attack left, and the town on the right for 3 millennia beneath the sand. So if it's 3 millennia, 1,000 years ago, if it's only just 1,000 years ago, it could be Iron Age. I may be wrong. If I thought it was 3,000 BC, it's definitely not Iron Age. It could be. Well, they keep on saying it, so it must be Iron Age. It must be, time. So it's just, a few hundred years before Pythagoras. The Iron Age citadel of Hasanlu was grand, with its paved streets and palatial homes that arose 2, sometimes 3 stories high around columned courtyards that must be only 1,000 years BC. Its people were rich and lived off the fertile lands generously irrigated by Iran's lake Ermla. Then they were massacred. Is that a beautiful, beautiful, quiet sentence? A lovely sentence there. Love that. Then they were massacred. Did this? Then they were killed. I was teaching for 10 years, and then I was attacked. The town was destroyed just before 800 BC. Okay, now I'm beginning to understand this a bit better. For some reason, when I first looked over, I said 3,000 years ago, and that stuck on 3. But 800 BC puts them just, possibly at contemporary with Pythagoras, in a brutal assault. Now, finally, the remarkable story of Hasanlu is being pieced together from the artifacts gathered half a century ago. These are revealing unique snapshot in history. Here, as in the ancient city of Pompeii, time stopped short. Only instead of capturing a natural disaster, Hasanlu captures the reality of Iron Age warfare in all its brutal detail. Now, when you actually come to think of it, when you read the Greek stuff, these are people are just finding the bejesus out of each other. You know, this is just part of their logic. Yet, while everyone knows about Pompeii, few have heard of Hasanlu. That is set to change. See, like that short sentence at the end? I'm going to use that in my writing, I think. In 1956, a young American archaeologist called Robert Dyson travelled to Iran, seeking a site where he could study the origins of sedentary life and farming. Now, what I really like is that they said, a man walked into a bar, and his name was John Wayne, the top of staff. I love it. He singled out a mound about 500 metres in diameter and 25 metres high. You know, that stood in a valley at the south end of Lake Irma. Previous digs had revealed it to be entirely artificial, the result of millennia of dust, dirt and debris building up around a succession of settlements that had occupied the spot starting in 5,000 or 6,000 BC. So that's where I've memorized that, because that would be stone or bronze age if you're lucky. It's now known locally as Hassan Loom. Dyson began by digging trenches around the base of the mound, and then, in 1958, on top of it. It wasn't long before he and his assistant discovered the charred remains of a magnificent Iron Age residence built around a courtyard. A fire had clearly destroyed the building's wooden structure, causing floors to collapse on top of each other and freeze its contents. So the fire just burnt from the top, multi-story, and it just went, archaeological dig, here you are. Its contents and inhabitants in time and space. Well, I suppose, yeah. So that instant of time, and then they're sandwiched, the floors swatted, like a fly swat. The archaeologists uncovered walls, floors, staircases, everyday objects, skeletons dressed in armor, and then a silver cup adorned with two rows of small feathers. 2 days later, they struck gold. Solid gold. Out of the ground emerged a large bucket-shaped vessel. Dyson wrote to the director of the Penn Museum, his funders at the University of Pennsylvania. Pressed flat by the weight of the earth, 8 inches high, 2 feet in circumference, a shining in golden splendor as only gold can do. What a fabulous treasure, covered with mythological figures and detailed and composition of which we are completely new to us, he quotes. With that, everything changed. The dig went onto turbo mode, says Michael Dante of the Boston University, who worked with Dyson's for decades, later. Huge plazas were traced and excavated, revealing the full scale of the citadel, and the settlement's inner sanctum containing public buildings and elite homes, which was about 30,000 square meters. Although 30,000 square meters sounds big, it's 300 square meters by 100 square meters. So that's basically a city, a suburban block in Australia. So an Australian home is 1,000 meters. So it's like 30 houses. So it's like a suburban block, small block. But sounds big. 30,000. Let's read it again. Yeah, 30,000. There you go. Not many. That's 300 meters by 100. So, like, a school in Australia would be that size. Dozens and dozens of bodies were found. Some burnt, others slain or impaled, and left to die. Mary Voigt, now emerita at William and Mary University, Virginia, arrived in 1970. Quote, "It was a really easy sight in terms of understanding the layers," she says. "Once you go down, not even a meter, you're on top of a citadel. If you were in a building, you would start to get all things that were on top of the first floor. Then, underneath, you'd have the ground floor. And once you've cleared away the top of bricks and slabs of stone, you'd find all the people." Oh, God. The first trench Voigt dug turned out to be a courtyard. Quote, "I found a little kid who was just lying on the pavement. The child was still... wearing a bronze bracelet, and next to them was a spear point and an empty quiver." So quiver's the, I think the bag is the box of, that you carry with all your spears. "The unusual thing about this site," she says, "is that all this action is going on and you can read it directly. Somebody runs across the courtyard, kills the little kid, dumps their quiver because it's out of ammunition. If you keep going, there are arrow points embedded in the wall. So bam, 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 you know, this. Next, avoid, imagine shooting a kid, and they can do it. That's inside human nature. Next, avoid, move to what had been a stable and found more bodies, all women, on top of the stable collapsed roof. They were in an elite part of the city, yet none of them had any jewellery, she said. Maybe they had been stripped, or maybe they were servants, who knows. But they were certainly herded back there and systematically killed. It's very vivid, too vivid. Subsequent studies led later by Janet Monge, M-O-N-G-E, of Penn Museum showed that most of these women had died from cranial trauma, the skull smashed by a blunt instrument. Good on you, work man. Good on your day's work. What I'm going to do today, I'm just going to massacre a few people. What are you doing today? I'm going in to something built by the people of Australia. I'm going to bully people. Okay, terrible atrocities. Yet this was one of a long list of apparent atrocities at Hansaloo. Skeletons were found with their hands grasping to adamant their necks. Many lacked hands, others had no heads. In one door frame, a complete skeleton lay sandwiched between two half skeletons. Elsewhere, traces of metal blades were found embedded inside a child's skull. I come from a long line of undertakers. Dead people are not scary to me, quote Sisswood. But when I dug that site, I had screaming nightmares. In the early 1970s, the excavations were shut down by the rumblings of the Iranian Revolution. Back in the US, the project catapulted Dyson to academic heights. Many of his assistants and students also went on to have illustrious careers. But Hansaloo itself fell into obscurity. No one ever got around to writing a full excavation report. Dyson could write, he had a writer's block, said Dante. Today, stacks of notebooks, diaries, drawings, diagrams, photographs from the excavations are kept in two rooms in the Penn Museum. In the basement, behind several locked doors, are thousands of objects. Everything that didn't go to Iran's National Museum in Tehran is packed away there. In recent years, Dante, and together with Megan Sifari of Manhattanville College at New York, and a few others, have been painstaking re-examining all the evidence in this, an attempt to reconstruct the events that led to the destruction of Hansaloo. The invaders, they conclude, came with heavy spiked maces, iron swords, knives, pointed helmets, with a single purpose, to wipe out a culture. That had stood on the spot for centuries. They hit the lower town first, killing as they went. All around, people fled their homes and made for the higher citadel, seeking protection. That's why they got the citadel and then they got killed. Okay. But Hansaloo's fortifications weren't up to the task. Soldiers flooded through a breach in the wall and continued their gruesome work. Men and women, children were all slain, alongside their dogs and horses. And looting was as thorough as the killing. At some point, amidst all of this, someone, probably a soldier, lit a fire. Wooden beams and reed matting went up in an almighty blaze. As the flames spread, some soldiers continued towards the grand buildings and temples of the inner sanctum. On the third story of a magnificent residence, three came across a treasury and caught sight of a large and delicate embossed gold ball, as well as an equally precious goblet made of fine silver. They grabbed both and raced to get out. Greed was literally their downfall. Before they reached the stairways, flame engulfed the building and collapsed beneath them. Their bodies plummeted and flattened under the bricks of the burning timber, where they were found 3 million years later, together with the objects of their desire. isn't that the most chilling and beautiful story? All around, other houses collapse. A group of 70 inhabitants who had sought refuge in the building across the street perish in their hideout. Elsewhere, a man and a boy hid in a grain store, which was then consumed in a blaze. When their skeletons were exhumed by Dyson's team in the mid-20th century, they appeared to be in a brace, with the older man holding the hands up to his mouth, as though to whisper into the ear. The press dubbed them lovers of Hansu. It was a bitter twist of irony. The flames that destroyed the mighty citadel would also save it for posterity. As the wooden framework gave way and the multi-story buildings flattened, they quenched the fire and preserved everything inside them, a tightly compacted layers of dust and crushed clay bricks. Occupants, enemy soldiers, their weapons, their jewels, their hand-painted bowls, they ate from the jars they drank wine from, and the layouts of their homes and palaces, everything was entombed. The destruction was complete, quote, "That narrows down who could have done it," says Dante. There are two major forces in the era of the times. The Assyrians had been a regional power for millennia, and now ruled from the cities of Nimrud and Nineveh. Now we've got those, I still know those two cities, to the west of Hansu. But their reign was in decline. The Euratians were a smaller but growing power to the north. Who was to blame? The many Assyrian objects found in Hasluu had originally led people to believe the city was an Assyrian ally or outpost by the time it was sacked. But Sifri isn't convinced. She's been going through the Hasluu records trying to correct what she calls some of the problematic conclusions that have been drawn about the site this past. She believes the extraordinary collection of exotic books point to a people doing their own thing. It's more likely that they were itinerant traders, she says, who brought the objects back from the travels to Assyria, amongst other places. In fact, a link with the Euterans looks stronger. Digs in Hasu's lower levels reveal that the town experiences lesser attack, 110,000 BC. Excavating a cemetery on the outskirts of the settlement, Sifri found a grave dating from not long after the attack, containing a warrior with the Euratian-style armor and weapons and wearing intriguing armlets that were too small to be removed, suggesting he must have worn them since childhood. Later, graves revealed the rise of a new warrior social class equipped with similar armor and swords. Sifri suspects that the century or so after 1100 BC attack, one or more warriors moved into Hansu from the north, bringing their military technology with them. It looks as though the town was preparing to defend itself during the period. As well as a growing army, the settlement had gained new fortifications around the citadel. The Dante's research indicates that the threat came where the threat came from. In 2014, he published an analysis of the skeletons and found with a golden bowl. From the dress, he concluded that they were Euratians. Ironically, they even wore the same armlets Sifri found in the cemetery. We know around this time the Euratians travelled past Hansu to visit one of their holy sites. Hansu may have been the residents resistant to Euratian invasion, says Seville. It seemed likely they weren't, that they didn't capitulate. The Euratians destroyed the site, and you notice the Mongols do this exactly, you know, this exact raise everything to the ground. Alexander the Great raised everything to the ground. You've got to recognise that this is the way things were, and my friends. Um, They did it in a way that was intentional and spectacular. It would have been a smoking heap of rubble that would have been seen for miles. The scale of it, actually says, it looks like a message to surrounding villages. Dante agrees that the invaders weren't mere thieves. Whoever destroyed the site really had an axe to grind against the people who lived there, he says. It's one of these invasions that's designed to wipe out the cultural identity. But there is another potential motive. John Curtis, the British Museum in London, points out that Hansi occupied a very desirable position in the middle of a fertile valley. It also seems that it may have been an important trade route for intersecting Lake Irma, Urama, and the Fertile Crescent, the birthplace of farming. In modern-day Iraq, the site was clearly important, says... But this is in Iran, but I don't quite understand... Yeah, I don't find this, and they've got, it could be Iraq, but they've mentioned Iran, okay. The site was clearly important, says Curtis. It has been occupied on and off for some 5,000 years, right back to the origins of agriculture. There were fortifications. Quote, it might have been in a position to control the trade route, she says. An obstacle that the Euratarians had to remove, and there was probably quite a lot of plunder in the city itself. Whatever the motivation of the attack, it laid waste to the town. Almost 3 millennia later, Hansu is finally rising from the dust. 5 years ago, a museum opened near the site to show some of the excavated artifacts. Now the Iranian government, it's not Iraq, okay. The Iranian government is seeking international recognition. In June, the Cultural Heritage and Handicrafts Organization of Iran announced that it was putting together a dossier for UNESCO in a bid to make Hansalu a World Heritage Site. Sifrelli is optimistic this will bring benefits to the local economy. Quote, and of course, it's an acknowledgement of the importance of the site, she says. 27 minutes in, that was quite a read, quite a phenomenal read. And now we come into another article, called Big Idea article, which I hope is good, and it's called AI Warbot. Artificial intelligence is set to rewrite the rules of warfare in subtle and terrifying ways, says Kenneth Payne. You know what? I really think that as how, I think Novichok is a bit of a wake-up, and some of the cyber-attacking is a bit of a wake-up, and I just don't think Australians are going to last. I think we've pissed too many people off. We're going to have a good old people coming down and massacre us at some stage. Okay. Artificial intelligence is set to rewrite the rules of warfare in a subtle and terrifying way, says Kenneth Payne. Only the dead have seen the end of war. The philosopher George Santana once rightly observed, what a beautiful story. Our martial instincts are deep-rooted. Our near relatives, chimpanzees, fight, quote, total war that sometimes leads to the annihilation of rival groups of males. Archaeological and ethnological evidence suggests that warfare amongst our hunter-gatherers ancestors was chronic. It's beautiful that they put this, yeah, this is the way to begin this article, given the last articles there. Over millennia, we have fought these wars according to the same strategic principles based on our understanding of each other's minds. But now we have introduced another sort of military mind, one that even though we program how it thinks, may not end up thinking as we do. We are only just beginning to work through the potential impact of artificial intelligence onto human warfare. But all the indicators are that they will be profound and troubling, in the way that are both unavoidable and unforeseeable. Well, yes, that's the entire thing of war. That you can't avoid it and you can't foresee what you're... enemy's going to do. We're talking here about the dystopian sci-fi trope of the malign humanoid robots with a free reign and killer instinct but the far more we aren't, but a far more limited sort of artificial intelligence that really that already exists. This AI is less weapon per se, more decision-making technology that makes it useful for peaceful pursuits and warfare alike, and thus it's hard to regulate and ban. Beautiful writing. What a fantastic writer, Kenneth. This connectionist AI is loosely based on neural networks of our brains. I wish people would define what AI is a bit better. Networks of artificial neurons are trained to spot patterns on vast amounts of data, gleaning information they can use to optimize, quote, reward functions representing a specific goal. By that, optimizing clicks on Facebook's feed, playing a winning game of poker or Go, or indeed winning out on the battlefield. And that's a beautiful description of what AI is. I really like that one. In the military arena, swarms of autonomous drones are already deployed from pods on aircraft. The autonomous software can maneuver vehicles with increasing dexterity. In the air, in simulators at least, it has outfought skilled pilots. There are systems that can scan hours of imagery looking for targets that automatically respond to incoming missile threats, that prioritize information for human pilots, and that shift radar bands in lightning fast battle of detection and deception. This raises obvious, but this is strange, I don't know about that one. Last one. This raises the obvious, much discussed ethical question. God. Whoa. Ethics. I think ethics takes a back seat in war. Can AI systems really know who to target? Shouldn't people have the final say in life or death decisions? But the implication of how far war is prosecuted for strategy have been less widely explored. To understand how profound they are, we must first understand strategy's very human underpinnings. Social intelligence gives humans a powerful advantage in conflict, in war, size matters. Victory generally goes to bigger battalions, a logic described in the formula derived by the British engineer Frederick Launceston from the studies of aerial combat in the First World War. He found that whatever the battle devotes to melee of all against all, with ranged weapons as well as close combat, a group's fighting power increases as the square of its size. That creates a huge incentive to form ever larger groups in violent times. Of course, that's, yeah, that seems rather limited. So at the moment, if you have a concentration of troops, they just put a B-52 strike on you. Okay, humans are good at this because we are good at understanding others. We forge social bonds with unrelated humans, including with strangers based on ideas, not kinship. Go Nazis. This is aided by shared language and culture. We have acute radar for deception and a willingness to punish non-cooperating free riders. All these traits have allowed us to assemble and organize and equip a large, increasingly potent forces to successfully wage war. This is the idea that you punish people. Social intelligence also allows weaker, smaller groups to stave off defeat. The use of deception, fortification, terrain, disciplined formations can offset the advantages of scale and shock. In the film 300, crack Spartan troops at one point charge headlong into a vastly outnumbered Persian army at the Battle of Thermopylae. In reality, that would spell disaster. As the ancient Greek historian Herodotus relates, the Spartans used the narrow confines of a mountain pass and charged and arranged themselves into a disciplined formation that interlocked shields to hold off the Persians. This too is strategic intelligence. Underlying is a theory of mind, the human's ability to gauge what others are thinking and how well they will react to give to a given situation, friend or foe. The ancient Chinese strategist Sun Tzu counseled leaders to know themselves and know their enemies, so that in 100 battles they would never be defeated. Theory of mind is essential to answer strategy's big questions. How much force is enough? What does the enemy want? And how hard will they fight for it? Strategic decisions making is often instinctive, unconscious, but also can be shaped by deliberate reflections and an... This is awful reading, isn't it, mate? Mm-hmm. It's awful reading. Attempt at empathy. This has survived even into the nuclear era. Some strategists and thinkers held that nuclear weapons changed everything because their destructive power threatened punishment against any attack. Rather than denying aggressors their goals, they deterred them from ever attacking. That certainly did require new thinking, such as the need to hide nuclear weapons, for example, on submarines, to ensure that no first strike could destroy all possibility of retaliation. Possessing nuclear weapons certainly strengthens the position of militarily weaker states, hence the desire of countries from Iran to North Korea to acquire them. But even in the nuclear era, strategy remains human, involves chance, and can be emotional. There is scope for misinterpretation and miscommunication, and a grasp of human psychology can be vital for success. Oh God, there's a picture of people patrolling with a drone above them. Oh, it's sickening. What's it? There's six soldiers patrol. They're obviously not really patrolling. They're too close to each other. Just walking through the battlefield. They're walking up. What are you thinking? Take the Cuban Missile Crisis, an event intensely studied by psychologists and strategists since. In 1962, US President John F. Kennedy was given alarming evidence that the Soviet Union was positioning nuclear missiles in Cuba. His immediate reaction was anger and a desire to strike out military, even at the risk of escalating the Cold War. But that soon gave way to deliberate, reflective attempt to empathize with Nikita Khrushchev's blustering. The Soviet leader had tried to bully Kennedy into the first meeting, at their first meeting, and during the crisis sent first an emboldened letter, then a tougher one. Kennedy crafted a solution that crucially saved Khrushchev's face. In a tense standoff, the social intelligence and theory of mind were decisive. Artificial intelligence changes this. First, it swings logic of strategy decisively towards attack. AI's patterns recognition makes it easier to spot defensive vulnerabilities and allows more precise targeting. Its distributed forms are hard to kill, but can concentrate rapidly on critical weaknesses before dispersing game, and allows fewer soldiers to be risks than warfare today. This all creates a powerful spur for moving first in any crisis. Combined with more accurate nuclear weapons in development, this undermines the basis of the Cold War nuclear deterrence, because a well-planned, well-coordinated first strike could defeat all defenders' retaliatory forces. Superior IA capabilities would increase the temptation to strike quickly and decisively at North Korea's small nuclear arsenal, for example. By making many forces, such as a crewed aircraft and tanks, practically redundant, AI also increases the uncertainty about the balance of power between states. States dare not risk having a second-rate military AI, because a marginal advantage in AI decision-making, accuracy and speed could be decisive in any conflict. AI espionage is already underway, and the scope of the new arms race is clear. It's difficult to tell who is winning, so safer to go all out with the best AI weapons. said that all, it would be tempting to say that RI represents just another shift in the strategic balance, as nuclear weapons did at their time. But the most unsettling Alex Lord change is that AI will make decisions about the application force very differently to humans. AI doesn't naturally experience emotion or empathy, or that are the sorts that guides human strategists such as Kennedy. We might attempt to encode rules for engagement into an AI ahead of a conflict, a reward function that tells what outcome it should strive for and how. At the tactical level, say with air-to-air combat between two swarms of rival autonomous aircraft, matching our goals to the reward function that we set out to AI might be doable. Win combat, survive, minimize civilian casualties. Such goals translate into code, even if there may be tensions between them. But single action knits together into military campaigns, things become much more complex. Human preferences for fussy, sometimes contradictory and apt change in the heat of the battle. We don't know exactly what we want and how badly ahead of time. Machine fleets have little chance for delivering those goals. There's plenty of scope for our wishes and an AI's reward function to part company. Recalibrating the reward functions takes time, and you can't just switch AI off mid-battle. Hesitate for a moment and you might lose. That is because we try to understand how the adversary may respond. Strategy is a two-player game, at least. If AI is competitive, it must anticipate what the enemy will do. In the most straightforward approach, which plays to the AI's tremendous ability in pattern recognition and recall, is to study an adversary's previous behavior and look for regularities that might be probabilistically modeled. This method was used by AlphaGo, the DeepMind AI which beat the human champion Lee Sedol, a board game Go in 2016. The Go board represents a large, yet still limited, toy universe with a vast array of possible future moves. Yet, given its opponent's likely response, the machine can narrow the search to the moves most likely to lead to victory, and then work out a winning course of action, all at blinding speed. With enough past behavior to go on, this works even in the games such as poker, where, unlike Go, not all information is freely available and a healthy dose of chance is involved. AI can now beat world-class poker players when it plays them repeatedly. Alright, pick it up. This approach could work well at the tactical level, anticipating how an enemy pilot might respond to a maneuver, for example. But it falls down as we introduce high-level strategic decisions. There's too much unique about any military crisis for previous data to model it. An alternative method is for AI to attempt to model the internal deliberations of an adversary. But this only works where the thing being modeled is less sophisticated as when an iPhone runs functional replicas of the classic 1980s arcade games. Our strategic AI might be able to intuit the goals of an equally sophisticated AI, but not how the AI will seek to achieve them. The interior machinations of an AI that learns as it goes are something of a black box, even those who designed it. Where the enemy is human, the problem becomes more complex still. AI perhaps incorporates themes of human thinking, such as ways to systematically inflate low-risk outcomes. But that is AI looking for patterns again. It doesn't understand what things mean to us. It lacks the evolutionary logic that drives our social intelligence. When it comes to understanding what others intend, quote, "I know that you know that she knows the machine still has a long way to go. Does that matter? Humans aren't infallible mind readers. In his sobering account of the nuclear strategy called the Doomsday Machine, Daniel Ellsberg describes a time when the original US early warning system signaled an incoming Soviet strike. In fact, the system's powerful radar beams were echoing back from the surface of the moon. Would a machine have paused for thought to ascertain that that error before launching a counterstrike, as humans involved did? Humans try to reason about what adversaries want and understand that within the context of their own experience, motivations and emotions. Machines may not share Kennedy's emotional knee-jerk response in 62, but they also don't share his capacity to reflect on his adversary's perspective. An AI's own moves are often unexpected. In its second game against Lee, AlphaGo made a radical move wholly unforeseen by unlooking human experts. This wasn't remarkable creativity or searing insight into Lee's game. The game-winning move 37 was shown to probabilistic reason and a flawless memory of how hundreds of thousands of early games had played out. The last thing we need is blindingly fast, offensively brilliant AI that makes startling and unanticipated moves in confrontations with other machines. There won't necessarily be time for human judgments to intercede in a battle of automatons before things get out of hand. At a tactical level, keeping a human in the loop would ensure defeat by faster all-machine combatants. Despite the stated intentions of liberal Western governments, there will be ever less scope for human oversight of a blurringly fast tactical warfare. Cold probabilities. The same may be true of the more elevated strategic levels. Herman Kahn, a nuclear strategist on whom the character Dr. Strangelove was partly based, conceived of carefully calibrated ladders of escalation. A conflict is won by dominating an adversary on one rung and making it clear that you will suddenly escalate several more rungs of intensity with incalculable risk to the enemy, what Cam called escalation dominance. In the real world, the rungs of the ladder are rather imprecise. Imagine two competing AI systems made of drones, sensors and hypersonic missiles locked in an escalatory system of chicken. If your machine backs off first, or even pauses to defer to your decision, it loses. The intensity and speed of action pushes automation ever higher. But how does the machine decide what will take to achieve escalation dominance over its rival? There is no enemy mind about which to theorize, no scope for compassion or empathy, no person to intimidate or coerce, just cold, inhuman probabilities decided at an instant. That was move 37 at AlphaGo's second game against the world champion. Perhaps it's also early December 2041. A vast swarm of drones skimming over the ocean at a blistering speed, approaching the headquarters of the US Pacific Fleet. We can't bury our heads into the sand and say it won't happen, because the technology already exists to make it happen. We won't be able to agree on a blanket ban because strategic advantage to anyone who develops it on the sly would be too great. The solution is to stop it happening in the spiritually familiar. To scholars of strategic studies to make sure you win the upcoming AI arms race. That's a rather a sobering article, isn't it? Giving a voice to the planet's suffering. Poetry can express our environmental crisis in a more human way, says Neil Frith. Poetry and nature have always gone hand in hand, but now there is a new bite as poets increasingly address environmental issues, adding politics and activism to their literary armoury. A big cash prize also helps. One of the biggest poetry prizes is the Gingo Prize, formerly the Resurgent Prize, which closed for submissions on the 15th of August, just in case you want to go. It awards £5,000 for the best poem on an ecological theme. Sally Crothers, Executive Director of the Poetry School, which helps manage the prize, says the recent rise of eco-poetry is being driven by an era in which we live and by people sharing their work on social media, particularly Instagram. In times of political unrest, poetry thrives as an activist medium, she says. People have something gritty to write about. The best environmental poetry doesn't berate or shout at you. Instead, the signs are subtle. The absences, the disturbances are cumulative. As Karen McCartney Wolfe's collection of seasonal disturbances. okay. Here, nature often seems ill at ease with itself. No birds nesting or singing in the trees. No bellowing, no roaring or squeaking, savage or small. Or take Beverly's Briar Banks poem, Le Fête de Mel, from her new book, The Hotel Eden. Here, bees are left confused by shifting climate. The last winter was so warm, the bees thought, summer never ended. The beekeeper's right. Poetry about the environment has also been scooping up big prizes usually reserved for longer forms. In June, poet Robert Minhit won the Wales Book of the Year Award for his Diary of the Lost Man. Poetry described an environmentalism turned to elegy by the judges. Perhaps this isn't surprising. Good poetry has the ability to pack emotional punch without cliche and avoid the didactic tone that can kill a piece of art. As Crothers explains, a great eco-poem must have an understanding of how we interact with species and ecosystems. That destruction and risk are part of the world in which we find ourselves and that we need to act now. While some of the best eco-poetry is about the resilience of nature, other works address the ways our changing climate affects minds and bodies. Kari Etta's pamphlet, Scar, for example, is a single poem about the effects of climate change on her home state of Illinois. More tornadoes, one scours a half-mile wild path through Fairdale, flattens, twirls, hurls homes, cars, a child's treehouse. The scar is Earth visible from space. It will be included in the collection of her The Weather is Normal. Other poets like Dom Bury and Sean Hewitt are bridging the gap between personal and global. Bury, the winner of last year's prestigious UK National Poetry Competition for the Open Field, runs workshops on eco-poetry and what he calls the emotional impact of climate change. Hewitt, winner of the Resurgent Prize in 2017, with his poem Ilex, describes his new work as trying to change through poetry ways in which we view our relationship with the natural world. I was commissioned in June to write a series of mini-poems for Ice Alive, a science arts project. As Joseph Cook, a co-founder of Ice Alive and glacial microbiologist, explains, arts can add depth and value back to the science of climate change. Crucially, it can engage those who haven't found a way to express their unease about an endangered world. It's interesting that Voltaire wrote poems and Newton wrote poems at the start of his books. So it's interesting about poetry beyond that level. Prudery isn't justice. Now, this is a book review. We discuss Deer's collective behaviour. Watch out, warns Simon Ings. The book is called Objection, I believe. We want the law to be fair and objective. We also want laws that work in the real world, protecting and reassuring us and maintaining our social and cultural values. The moral dilemma is that we can't have both. This may be because humans are hopelessly irrational and need a rational legal system to keep them in check. But it may also be that rationality has its limits. Trying to sit in judgment over everything is as cruel, as farcical as gathering cats in a sack. This dilemma is down to discuss, says Deborah Lieberman, a psychologist at the University of Miami, and Captain Patrick, a legal scholar at the University of Central Florida. In objection, they joined forces to consider why we find some acts disgusting without being reprehensible, like nose picking, while others seem reprehensible without being disgusting, like drunk driving. Disgust is such a powerful intuitive guide that has formed our morality and hence our legal system. But it maps badly over the jurisprudence built on notions of harm and culpability. Worse, terms of disgust are frequently wielded against people we intend to marginalise, making disgust a dangerous, fissile element in our moral armoury. Beautiful. Can science help us manage it? The prognosis is not good. If you were to ask a cultural anthropologist, a psychologist, a neuroscientist, a behavioural economist and a sociologist to explain disgust, you would receive different, often mutually contradictory opinions. The authors make their own job much more difficult, however, by endorsing a surreally naive model of the mind, one in which both emotion and cognition require circuitry. And it's possible to increase a child's devotion to family by somehow manipulating this circuitry. From there, the reader is ushered into a lollipop van of evolutionary psychology, where disgust is best understood as a type of software program instituted by our neural hardware, which evolved originally to guide our ancestors when making decisions about what we eat. Yeah, that's essentially... The idea that disgust is to some degree taught and learned, conditioned by culture, class and contingency, is not something easily explored using the author's overriding model of the mind. Whenever they lay this model aside, however, they handle ambiguity well. Their review of literature on disgust is cogent and fair. They point out that although discrimination of homosexuality and gay marriage argues persuasively for legal rationalism, there are other acts like the violation of corpses that we condemn with a strictly rational basis. The corpse isn't complaining. This plays to the view of bioethicist Leon Cass, who calls disgust the only voice left that speaks up to defend the central core of our humanity. Objection explores an ethical territory and that sends legal purists sprawling. The authors emerge from the interzone battered, but essentially unbowed. Last Trump. An ill-judged tweet kicks off nuclear war in a satire pitting North Korea against the US. Jacob Aron. The 2020 Commission report on North Korean nuclear attacks against the United States. This is quite interesting. By Jeffrey Lewis, Penguin. In the past year, whenever US-North Korea relations were at a particularly low point, I would wake up in the middle of the night, reach to my phone, and check Twitter to see if nuclear war had begun. That's a social media service could play a role at the end of the world once seemed absurd, but such is the reality of 2018. I was reminded of this when I was idly scrolling through my feed, a message jumped up at me in my tracks. Little Rocket Man won't be bothering us much longer, screamed a scowling face of Twitter-in-Chief. Is this it? I wondered before noticing the username not real Donald Trump. Not at real Donald Trump. The US President's genuine account is but the TEH Donald Trump. Investigating further, I discovered this was a parody account set up to promote the 2020 Commission report on the North Korean attacks against the United States. Official but ultra-real account of nuclear conflict on Twitter, in which Twitter plays a defining role. It's written by Jeffrey Lewis, an arms control expert at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey in California, who is frequently quoted in the pages of New Scientist. This story takes the form of an official US report published in 2023 to determine the causes of the North Korean nuclear attack. Its tone, set midway between bureaucratic sterility and a Tom Clancy thriller, works very well. It helps that both genres heavily favour acronyms. The setup A technical glitch in the South Korean passenger jet, inspired by a real-life aircraft failure, leaves the pilot drifting along the North Korean along the Korean border. The Koreans mistake the plane for a US bomber and shoot it down, sparking retaliation of South Korean missiles. Lewis ratchets up the tension as the Korean leader Kim Jong-un and Moon Jae-in decide how to act. The Hurricane Donald, as one of the chapter's title, comes into play. His ill-fated Rocket Man tweet prompts Kim to retaliate with North Korea strikes on nuclear strikes in South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. mainland. The maps lay out the devastation in chilling detail. A nuke exploding over New York City creates a 1 kilometer fireball. Most residential buildings in Manhattan are destroyed, including Trump Tower, and people within 6.5 kilometer radius receive radiation burns. Needless to say, hospitals are plunged into chaos. Without medical treatment, radiation kills 50 to 90% of those exposed. You can follow Lewis's example and create your own scientifically accurate nuclear destruction. There's an online tool called NukeMap. It's the kind of thing if that's the kind of thing you enjoy. The commission reports the story of those who survived the blast. I was shocked to reach the end of the book and discover the testimonies were adapted from accounts of people who had survived the nuclear bombs dropped from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Grounding these historical words in our present-day reality brings home true horror of nuclear weapons. If the book has one flaw, it's the portrait of Donald Trump. While the US president is known for his outlandish statements and short attention span, Trump in the novel is too broad. For all his flaws, I don't believe Trump would declare a nuclear fireball rising over the coast of Florida as absolutely beautiful. A statement from the fictional Trump at the end of the report, the crying fake news, also comes across as generic bashing. That said, I couldn't put the book down, read most of it in the course of one increasingly intense evening. If fear of nuclear war is going to keep you up at night, at least it can be a page turner. Letters. Life expectancy is much worse if you're poor. From Alan Tolman, Birmingham, UK. Claire Wilson and Andy Coughlin over many of the possible explanations for the decrease in improvement of life expectancy in the UK, but they missed out one. The effect is historically more noticeable in poor than the wealthy. There is a measurable gradient of difference across all social classes. It has been known since the time of the Whitehall studies into the health of UK civil servants, led by Michael Marmot. The first of these, published in 1984, showed that civil servants in lower grades died on average sooner than those in more senior positions, though the latter had far more responsibility in their roles, and also intended to come from higher socioeconomic groups. One crucial question is, why are poor people affected more than those who are better off across all societies? The key is admitting the presence of health inequality and injustice it entails. In turn, I would argue it raises a key ethical question that anyone looking at changes in health outcomes needs to consider. Another possible effect on the rate of allergies. From Peter Bradford, Potters Bar, Hereford, UK. Penny Sashet discusses what causes allergies. In an early article on non-specific effects of vaccines, Michael Brooks writes that some may protect against allergies, while others encourage them. Nigel Kirkus of the Royal Children's Hospital of Melbourne and University of Melbourne, Australia, says vaccines were using weakened viruses to stimulate the type 1 immune system that combats viruses and bacteria, while vaccines using dead viruses may stimulate the type 2 system that fights parasites. So measles and BCG vaccines might help to compensate for the lack of type 1 immune training in outdoor environment and push towards a natural type 1 dominance. A whooping cough vaccine may push the system towards a type 2 dominance and hence vulnerability to allergies. Has this been discredited? If not, this may progress may be made in, for example, double-blind trials of different vaccines. Why do relatives have a veto on organ wishes? You report that opt-out system for organ donations could reduce transport rates, as relatives has less confidence their late family members agreed and so more likely to veto donation. I've always wondered why families are permitted to veto an individual's decision about organ donations. They aren't allowed to veto instructions on the distribution of assets after death, as specified in will. Remove the ability for families to veto and the potential problems of opt-out system would vanish. If that can't be done, we could allow a veto for opt-out cases unless the individual concerned has specifically and optionally indicated the wish to donate. Contraception is not just a women's responsibility. I was pleased to see a variety of speakers depicted in your New York Scientist Live. It's great to see scientific community become more inclusive and thereby enrich and inspiration. However, I'm disturbed by the cartoon accompanying Ian Ankers' comment on population. All eight parents depicted as causing runaway global warming appear to be women. My understanding was that half the parents are men. Ankers rightly reiterates that contraception should be available to all, but then refers to women choosing whether and when to bear children. Can men not choose contraception? Finding on solar cycles comes around again. From Bruce Dennis Whittle Isle of Wight, UK. Michael Marshall reports that a team from China University Geosciences in Beijing has found evidence of the 11-year solar spot cycle in Precambrian sedimentary rocks in South China. More than 50 years ago, Roger Anderson observed not only the 11-year cycle, but also resonances at 5.5 and 2.5 years in Precambrian valved sediments consisting of annual layers. Hubert Lam added other examples in his 72 book. Yeah, there's much to it. Michael, always searching for another particle. Michael Brooks introduces us to the search for a particle that combines the axon flavon, axiflavon, or a companion to this plus a Higgs, or some more convoluted combination. This reminded me of reading The New Scientist in the mid-1960s for the search of the Omega Minus, a particle needed to complete the symmetry model of particle physics. We need to find one then, we need to find one now. The editor writes, yes, the Omega Minus was discovered, confirming our model of quarks. The exoflavon is slightly different in that it wouldn't itself confirm any grand theoretical framework. The roots of secure computing hardware. Sally Adi mentions work on more secure computer hardware carried out by Ruby Lee Howie Schrob from the late 1970s and late Roger Needham and others, including Bart Stutrup, went on to design C++ programming. This is interesting, C++. So turn the page. Language. I worked on CAP computer, which embodied a capability architecture at the University of Cambridge Computer Laboratory. It also had security as a fundamental concept. Access to all sections of memory, for example, was controlled by capability tokens. This system, being experimental subject to being upgraded and built in-house, occupied several mainframe racks, though I'm sure it would occupy a tiny fraction of today's central processing units. If there's a cat killer, if there's a London cat killer, we should worry. London, Ontario, Canada, and Barnfield. I agree with Adam in fighting Stephen Harris's claim regarding foxes killing cats unconvincing. If a fox had weak jaws, why would it chew off and then remove the head, which is presumably not, it would not eat, rather than going for the soft underbelly, where the internal organs would be available as food? There is an established link between animal abuse and the abuse of humans, human currently or escalation of behaviour. If this is a person, then they need to be stopped for the sake of the cats, but also potentially for other humans. The editor writes, our longer outline version of Harry's piece noted that because foxes have weak jaws, they start chewing at the narrower parts of the carcass, including the necks, where they can easily get grip with the sharper molars side of their teeth. Sheep farmers have seen foxes do this on dead lambs. The five commandments of robotics need work. From Brian Bourne, West Launceston, Tasmania, Australia. Douglas Heaven suggests five commandments for robots. I agree with the last commandments that robots should have an off switch, but I think the others need more work. For example, the first prevents robots from allowing a human to become to harm, unless it's supervised by another human. Does this make it okay for a soldier to send a robot into a house with instructions to kill anything that moves if the soldier is right behind supervising? The second one requiring that a robot must be able to explain itself won't work because humans can't do that either. An expert palate could distinguish canned beer. From Alistair Muat, Bolton, Pebbleshire, UK. Bob Humes describes the importance of yeast to the flavour of alcoholic drinks. This brings to mind a weekly event in the laboratory at the brewery at Edinburgh, where I began my career in the 1960s. The company owns several breweries through the UK, all of which produce the same brand of canned beer. We collected samples from each brewery and carried out a range of physical tests to ensure they were producing identical beer. The final test was blind tasting with glasses of beer set at random order. To the lesser mortals, they all tasted the same, but the head brewer identified them. This one's from Tadcaster, Belfast, and this is good, it's ours. The brewery had its own strand of yeast, developed over many years, and each yeast produced its own subtle flavours. Dismissing anecdotes can drive pseudosciences, by Echo Gonzalez, Chicago, Illinois. Ron Hooper was disappointed by talks at the International Dream Conference. I share his skeptical opinion of parapsychology. But it isn't just dangerous to dismiss the hypothesis simply because they are difficult or impossible to prove via scientific method. Say someone has anecdotal dream-related experience that cannot be explained yet by science. If they find, on attempting to discuss these, that the scientific community not only responds is dismissed this realm of study as head-shakingly laughable, that person is more likely to seek answers in pseudoscience, and that is dangerous. And the last word, as we come along here. Why is there no insulation for saucepans, or around kitchen sinks or bathtubs? It's difficult and expensive, or just lazy, traditional, inherent from wasteful, innocent times. There's no insulation around saucepans because it would hamper the heating of the pan's contents. Pots and pans use heat-conducting materials to make heat transfer more efficient. Plastic baths keep bath water hot much better than old-fashioned metal ones. However, if a long, lingering bath is your desire, you could remove the bath panel and fill the airspace around the bath with mineral wool, the kind used in loft insulation. You may wish to consider using bubble bath because this diminishes evaporation from the water surface, the main source of heat loss from plastic baths. As for sinks, how long does it take you to wash some dishes? This sounds like a gosh. If you have lots of dishes, the water will probably get dirty and you should have to replace it for hygiene reasons before it has cooled. One lazy tradition inherited from wasteful innocent times is lying soaking in the bath for ages like the Romans. Using gas, and to a lesser extent, electric radiant heating, the pot is heated from the sides as well as from the bottom. Insulating it would make it a little self-defeating. Energy and water efficiency were two of the driving forces behind the design decisions I made for myself, skin-tained, all solar-powered motorhome. Using my induction cooker, I tested a collapsible silicone kettle against a conventional metal one. There's no significant difference in the time or energy taken to boil the same volume of water. The immersion kettle took less time, but the same energy. I concluded that heat loss through the vessel size and the top was small relative to the heat input. The bigger waste is likely to be boiling more water than required. I haven't pursued the side or lid insulation for pots, but I use a slow cooker which puts the heated pot in a vacuum insulated container. I did consider whether a large diameter pots were more water and energy efficient than small diameter ones, but the differences were minimal. I based my selection of a motorhome sink on minimising the thermal mass, maximising the depth of water for minimum volume, and being able to fit our largest dish in the pot into the sink and wash it. Insulation was given, but I had to add it myself. This is from Queensland, Australia. Traditional certainly plays a role. Our ancestors a century ago had little understanding of energy conservation and few effective options for insulating material. Even so, a shortage of fuel led people to use techniques such as hay box cooking, in which the food is first heated in boiling water and kept in a box insulated with straw until cooked. It was slow, but it worked. Nowadays, a wide variety of insulated cookware is available and generally works well, especially for people who work all day and like to come back to ready-cooked meals. As for sinks and pipes, modern materials have led to all sorts of insulated plumbing, whereas insulation in the past tend to be expensive and fragile. New baths and hot water pipes are made of plastic, which are reasonably insulating, so they retain heat fairly well. In flats where I lived as a child, the hot water supply was heated centrally and distributed through metal pipes. These conducted the heat away from the water until my father showed the owner how to make insulating cement jackets for the pipes. South Africa. A range of stainless steel pots with excavated double walls and lids was popular in Switzerland 700 years ago. It was marketed abroad at least as far as Austria, and I secured a set for my godchildren who lived there. Since then, they have faded from the hardware departments of Geneva and appeared absent in the rest of Switzerland these past 4 years. This cannot be due to the poor durability because the pots I took to Austria are still in regular use and good condition. When I cooked New Year's lunch early this year. Thanks a lot for listening.
Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.